Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, this is Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. We're here today with Hannah Keller, who's an estate director at the Keller Estate Winery and a tour de force behind Petaluma Gap Formation, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Hello, Anna. It's great to have you.
It's wonderful to be here.
Thank you. And I would really love to start with your background. We've known each other for a little while now, and I know how deep your family roots go when it comes to viticulture, and I wanted to ask you to give us a little background on how the Keller family got started, how you got involved.
So it's 2019, and we're celebrating our 30th anniversary of planting our vineyard. So we bought a property in 1983 in Petaluma, not with really the expectations of growing grapes, but I'm originally from Mexico. My dad came, we came on a fantastic vacation in the late 70s to the Bay Area, and he fell in love with the area and with his wife. So it kind of started living half of our life in Mexico and half of our life here. And over the few years, he bought a property and would always drive the old cars that he loves through the windy roads of Sonoma until one day they decided to settle at that property. There was a house on the property, and he built a small garage to test drive his cars, a small road, and eventually they decided to do some plantings. They wanted to do something that felt right in that place. And this is 1989. There's no vineyards out on Lakeville Highway in Petaluma. Sonoma Coast is not yet an AVA, or just barely becoming an AVA, and the closest wine growing region is Carneros. So when we start looking what we can grow, UC Davis comes back and says, well, you know what, grow Chardonnay. Worst case scenario, if it doesn't ripen, you could always sell it to a sparkling producer. So we planted Chardonnay. They told us Pinot Noir would be too cool of a region for Pinot Noir. I guess global warming was not such a day-to-day threat as it is today. So we planted Chardonnay, and we were very fortunate that 3 years later, when our first grapes came into production, Rombauer was looking for fruit. So luckily for us, in the early 90s, Rombauer needed Chardonnay, and we had Chardonnay. So we really started our life as growers, and within a few years, my dad got the bug and decided to have 1 ton fermented for himself. I studied biochemistry. I was thinking today as I was coming to the interview that since I've been in junior high school and high school, I've always had plants in my bedroom. I've always been trying to grow something and seeds, and just really wanted to do something with plants. So things came together in such a way that he needed somebody to start working on that wine, that ton he had made, that had a stuck fermentation, and he didn't know what a stuck fermentation was. And I was just a recent graduate of college and needed a job. So we sort of found ourselves midway, and I started working with him. So we've been growing grapes ever since, selling grapes, and in 2000, we formally started Keller Estate.
Mm-hmm. So are you still selling fruit?
We are still selling fruit. I'm a grower at heart. It's wonderful to grow grapes and sell them. It also gives me a relief to know that they're going to great hands.
Perfect. So who are some of the producers, if you could mention, that you're selling fruit to that people might recognize?
So we've sold to many people in the past. We've sold to fruit to Flowers for many years.
Wow.
We've sold fruit to Patson Hall for a few years, to Hanzel for other years, to small, tiny producers that have been making wine from our Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, like Soliste, Tolosa, which is part of the Alpha Omega family.
Sure.
So kind of a variety of, I see more and more wineries that are maybe outside of Sonoma, Napa producers that want a Pinot Noir in their portfolio. And we fit the bill.
Well, they're all blue chip producers, let's say that. They all make fantastic wines with your grapes. So it must have been, you know, a tall order conceptually when you started your brand to make sure that your wines are also as delicious and wonderful as what these producers are showcasing with your fruit.
It's true, but I also have the commitment to our wines forever, whereas they can grow grapes and then move to another vineyard that they select. I always say that being all estate means you're stuck with yourself. That's right. You can only make, so you have to truly honor what the fruit is and not try to go through, you know, faces or fashion and, you know, go to kind of de-stem fruit, no de-stem. So I'm always very conservative in terms of making sure that the fruit comes first and not any wine fashion that I hear about or any new technique that I'm interested in exploring.
So this sounds like a cornerstone of your winemaking philosophy is to honor the fruit first and foremost and to show the vintage. Would that be a correct assessment?
Yeah, I always say that, you know, if you join, you know, enjoying our wines, it's seeing the passage of time through our grapes. So every year it's the same grapes and we just try to honor what the vintage was and what the fruit wants to be.
Well, that's admirable that you're not subject to trends and different iterations. But the fact that you're so committed, I think, bodes well for the consumer because they probably have come to expect high quality and you always deliver. When you have a customer in mind as a brand, who is that person and what do you want them to receive as a result of purchasing your wine?
It's funny because I've had one of our wine club members, he's been probably our oldest wine club member, and he passed at the age of 93 last year. But I would always think about him because he was the first person to ever try our grapes. He's a family friend and he knew the Chardonnay. He told me about the Pinot Noirs. He would call me when he didn't think that the style was spot on. One year I went to a heavier glass bottle and he called me immediately and said, you know what, this is too heavy, I can't carry it up the stairs. So it was always great to have a consumer that actually was a living consumer in mind and that I wanted to please. I also want to please the family because it is, after all, a family business, and the style has to be something that everybody feels that they can be ambassadors. But I also, you know, we always drink wines with family, with food, and with friends. So as long as everybody has a good time, I don't get hung up on the specifics, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm.
What is the highest praise you've ever received for your wine that touched you the most?
You know what? It's funny. I still get giddy when I'm at a restaurant and somebody orders our wine. When I see somebody that I don't know far away at a table order our wine, that for me is the highest compliment.
That's wonderful. And your wine is available in many restaurants in the Bay Area, is that correct?
Yeah. And slowly we're kind of growing our distribution, which as a small winery is always a challenge, but we're getting there.
That's great. Tell us a bit about your winemaking, why you hired your current winemaker, what attracted you to working with him and your collaborative efforts.
Well, ever since I started, I was in charge of everything from vine to bottle. So I learned early on that it might not be in my cards to be the full-time winemaker. I would always have to partner with somebody who could do the day-to-day activity and that I could really trust to put the fruit before themselves, just as I put the fruit before myself. Mm-hmm. So currently, Julian Teichmann, a young German guy, is making our wines. And it's great. He's got a lot of old, you know, he comes from a very traditional winemaking philosophy and education. He studied in Germany, but he's also he came to America because he wanted to experiment. So I find that for me, it's a great combination of honoring tradition while always looking for ways to improve.
And how long has he been working for you?
So he has been working for us for a little over 2 years. He started as assistant winemaker. So as always, he started producing some wines, then he got to finish some of the wines, and 2018 is his full first vintage.
Got it. Is there such a thing as a house style for you?
There is. I think, you know, I guess my palate has become the house style. So I always make sure that we taste as a group, that we challenge ourselves. And I do realize that most of the time I am the guiding house palate, but I'm hoping that the team, whether it's our hospitality team and winemaking, they can keep me honest.
Mm-hmm. What influences you? A lot of people derive a lot of instructive data from tasting wines from other countries, from older vintages, and kind of keeping an eye on worldwide, if you will, offerings. And some people get very centric to their brands and try to stay very focused on that. And of course, there's much in between. What influences you as far as your house style and your general philosophy of winemaking?
Well, we do two things. We're always tasting formally wines from all over the world, or varietals from all over the world. So we will actually, next Wednesday, we'll be doing a Syrah tasting. So we're gathering Syrahs from all over the world that we admire, and putting Keller Estate on the lineup and see how we enjoy it and what we see that makes us unique. But we also hold tastings with the people who buy our grapes every year. So I'm seeing what they're doing from the fruit that they grow, that we grow. And that always keeps it good. I always say it's a very cathartic event, because everybody comes with their wines that are not yet bottled. They're not yet blended. Some struggled with the fermentation. Some people, you come and then you realize that they used an oak that you find really, enticing or interesting. And so little by little, those two things keep us in balance. And at the end of the day, I really do think you were asking about a consumer. I can't please everybody. Mm-hmm. All I can do is be consistent, improve the quality, and find the people who appreciate that. I can't be in control of other people's palates. So you just sort of have to accept that you can produce the best you can. And again, my consistency is our fruit.
So you've heavily focused on Pinot Noir and Chardonnay production, obviously, and have experienced a great deal of success. And I think you are quite beloved as a brand by many consumers. So I want to talk about those two subjects separately. Pinot, of course, is always subject to the sideways effect. It gave it a lot more recognition. How has your journey, if you will, progressed? I know it started with the growing for many brands and then became your own, but what are your thoughts on the evolution of Pinot, both from the point of view of perception and production in this country?
So I'm going to have to go to Chardonnay first before answering Pinot.
That's totally fair.
It's funny because in 2003, we started making a stainless steel fermented, non-malolactic, aged in neutral oak Chardonnay because we felt that everything was the complete opposite. Everything was big and overblown and heavy oaked. You know, almost 15 years later, I don't see any more need for that wine because the market has really shifted back to a more centered place for Pinot Noir, for Chardonnay. So, you know, whereas before you had like the un-oaked and the highly oaked or really heavily oaked, now you see a lot more things in the middle. The middle is a lot more balanced. So, but in Pinot, I think we're still at the pendulum swing. We've got some people that are the overripe fruit expression, and you've got the very lean, especially in California, maybe not worldwide, but in California, you still have kind of really rich and intense Pinot Noirs and very light, structure-driven Pinots rather than fruit-driven Pinots. And I think that there's still time, we're still in the exploration of the middle ground for Pinot Noir. Personally, I'm looking for that middle ground, and I'll taste some people. We make two Pinot Noirs, one that's a bit more fruit forward and the other one that's a little bit earthier and more structured in tannins. And when they're looking for a California Pinot, they want a fruitier Pinot Noir. And when it's a consumer that is not looking to resell the wine, they choose whatever they like, which may be one of the two. So I think that Pinot's still finding itself, and it will always be in search of itself.
Hmm. So going back to Chardonnay, I've always felt that it's more of a winemaker's grape. It tends to take a lot of the personality of the maker onto itself. Feel free to disagree. That's just kind of the opinion that
I agree, actually.
good. So in that spirit, your observations are very interesting because, in fact, stylistically, Chardonnay has been influenced based upon the belief system of the maker. And I think the trade as well has had a lot to say about it in the recent years as far as more elegant, more minerally wines that are more food friendly, which is a term I'm not necessarily a fan of, but I'll throw it in there because that's dominant rhetoric. So as far as Chardonnay is concerned, moving forward into the future, What is your vision for your brand with respect to that variety?
It is, again, it really, you know, it's going back to finding the best expression of our estate fruit. So it is going back and saying, well, this is what our Chardonnay can be. And I'm not as much, we've actually started to discontinue the second Chardonnay, the Oro de Plata. I see that I personally am not able to craft two very distinct wines anymore. I've just found what Chardonnay wants to be from our property, and I've come to respect that. I've always been, you know, I don't have the luxury of buying fruit from a particular vineyard and 5 years later not liking it and moving to another vineyard and exploring that new vineyard. I'm stuck with myself, as I said at the beginning. So it's really important for me personally that the wines that I make, if it's from the same varietal, that they be very distinct. I have this obsession about not confusing the consumer, our consumers, with two wines that they don't know which one they really like. And I got to a point with a Chardonnay where I realized I was confusing them because they were not as different as they should be. And my consumers were struggling. So we decided to remove one of the two wines and focus. And the Pinots, right now, I still feel that we do make, whereas in the Chardonnays, there's a lot of oak, no oak, malolactic, no malolactic, steering, less steering involved. In the Pinots, we really do focus on it being a lot more about the site. Mm-hmm. About the clone. The winemaking stays predominantly the same, but we do fine tune oak where we find oak that's a little bit better for one particular clone or for one vineyard. So we are exploring, and I still feel that we can make two very beautiful, distinct Pinot Noirs.
So you've touched upon the clonal selections, which I always find fascinating. I know there's been a huge trend in the U.S. to chase Dijon, the sweetheart clones, and for good reason. On the other hand, a lot of people like more of a heritage variety and, again, polarizing opinions all around. How have you handled your vineyard in terms of, have you replanted anything? You know, what's going on with your viticulture, I guess?
Well, when I started, I was very fortunate to find a great mentor in Ted Lemon, who you know well.
Oh, of course.
And he always said that we were like an iceberg, and the vineyard was the sustaining layer of the iceberg. And so I had to have a really solid vineyard. That I might struggle a vintage here, might a vintage there, but if I had a good vineyard to go back to, I'd be okay. And I always remember those words. And we have a variety of clonal selections. So my role over the past 19 years has been we still ferment every clone individually from every block individually. And fortunately for us, we had planted the vineyard before we actually built the winery. So when we built the winery, we knew we needed a lot of small tanks so that we could be as specific to each clone as we wanted. So as the time went by, we already knew what we had in the vineyard, and we've continued, but the exploration has been how to better farm each parcel, how to better ferment each block or each clone, what oak does it, you know, what would wines want each clone. So for example, the La Cruz Pinot Noir that we make is predominantly Pommard clone, and the El Coro has absolutely no Pommard clone. So I've kind of been able to start making the wines from conceptually from two distinct vineyards, but also by kind of limiting the clonal selection to each wine, I'm able to focus on certain things that I think showcase each region, each site better. So for me, Pommard clone, I always call it sort of a Christmas tree clone because it's got a really great backbone, like a Christmas tree, and kind of on top. And then I hang other smaller clones onto it, and those are the decorations. So you've got a really nice linear structure in the Pommard clone, and then some of the other clones just add the fruit forwardness, the acid, the aromatics. El Coro, having no Pommard, has no backbone. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a much more layered, and so the tannins have a different, they're more horizontally structured, and that creates a very different, more complex Pinot Noir that opens up in a different way.
I'm hearing you say a lot about refinement, a lot of details, which I love, but also you almost mentioned shape-like concepts. How do you see wine?
Well, you know what? When I started, you know, I loved to drink wine. And funny enough, I had studied with who was to be my husband in England, and we took a wine appreciation course. He had the better palate than I did. But later on, it turns out I was going to be the one in the wine business. I knew my palate better than I knew my nose, if you may. So I've always been very much about the textures and how wine feels on the mouth, and how it, when you were talking about food and wine pairings and being food friendly, you know, I always want a wine that stands up to the food but doesn't overpower the food. It has to be a good compromise between, there's nothing I hate more than having to do a winemaker dinner and somebody tell me, send two bottles to the chef so he can make the menu. I'm always like, well, what about me? What about the wine? You know, we're not just another spice. We are truly, it's a 50-50 relationship here. And so I'm always very much about looking at wine in terms of how it feels in the mouth. So I do see a very physical form aspect to it.
That's wonderful. Food friendly, unfortunately, as I touched upon briefly earlier, became more of a marketing term, but there's a real science and there's real gravitas behind it, which is what you just described. And I loved what you said about your active participation. It's really not about the chef's vision of how to formulate something and kind of cobble it together, I suppose, for lack of a better term, but wine has to stand on its own. What have been some of the biggest challenges for you, but culturally, in terms of production, and then we'll talk about the marketing in a minute.
So viticulturally, we've converted the vineyard to organic. We are, and I would say that weeds have become my nemesis.
Oh, no.
The biggest challenge, weeds and people. You know, I don't know what order. I think people first and then weeds, because people need to get rid of weeds. But coming to a balance between how much, what we can tolerate, what works. But it certainly has been the biggest. In order to make any change, you need a great team behind you, willing to support you and willing to trust you and willing to change. And in viticulture, it's really hard because some of the actions are a bit of a toss-up. Is it really going to work? Is it going to give us better quality? If I drop fruit now, if I reduce leaves right now, am I really going to get better yields, better quality? Am I going to really do what I'm setting out to do? So the team really needs to trust you. And sometimes when you're not 100% sure of something and you're still experimenting, it is really a challenge to say it with confidence and to, you know, you got to really trust yourself that it's going to work out.
I think that's a natural segue to the marketing piece of this two-part question, which is the branding and marketing. I think a lot of small brands, in this case wineries, don't recognize the value in it. And what you just stated very assertively is that you have to own your voice. First of all, my compliments. Was that a natural, organic thing for you always, or is it something you kind of evolved into that level of confidence that what you say is really motivated by your experience, the fact that you've been in the industry and have tended to your brand, every day and invested so heavily in it? Where does this come from?
From my dad.
Oh.
That's a really easy answer. My dad has been, he's still very active, and he still wakes up every day thinking, how can I do things better? And he's never complacent and doesn't mind not being complacent. You know, it's really, as a daughter, it's been hard growing in a family where nothing's ever good enough. But you get used to it. And all of a sudden you realize that you've become that. So my kids complain about that now. So it's clearly done a good job. But you realize that every day you're just pushing a little bit more. And then you forget how hard it was the day before, because you're pushing forward. And it just keeps you focused on the next step. And you just embrace the past as it is.
It's almost the power of will, in a way.
It's without the almost. It's the power of will. If you can't believe it, you can't do it. And that's always been my dad's philosophy, is if you don't believe you can do it, you're not going to be able to do it.
There's a teachable moment. You've observed, you know, different ebbs and flows of the wine industry for the last 30 years, really. Walk us through it a little bit from your point of view. What is the wine world today? And maybe talk about the past or the other way around, whatever sounds more natural to you. But I want to hear from your perspective what, with respect to specifically California wine industry, landed like on you for the last 30 years.
Well, when I started, I was a 27-year-old, recently graduated female in charge of starting a wine brand. And I remember not being, kind of not feeling adequate and not feeling like I had knowledge. And I couldn't go back to school and get the right credentials to be able to say, I know this because I studied it. So I was learning on the job, and I've been learning on the job for the past 30 years without really knowing what are truly, you know, and in the 30 years, becoming passionate about what I love and what I feel are my true strong assets. But moving from there, I think I've seen it evolve into a much more mature. The other day I was reading about the state of the California wine industry and Sonoma County tourism between the fires and things like that has not been growing as much, but it also has become a much more mature industry. We expect much more from Sonoma and from California. And I think we've seen a great development of maturity in our wine industry that leads us, but we still doubt ourselves. In Sonoma, we still doubt that we have the quality. We still try to explain exactly who we are, and we are still struggling to find what the identity is. I recently saw a post about somebody wanting to state five wines that talked about the history of Sonoma County. And that's really hard. Sonoma County is very diverse, mm-hmm. and that diversity makes it a bit complex to understand what has evolved. Personally, I do think that I honestly never believed that I would be part of the creation of an AVA. I just didn't think it. I didn't even think it would be something that would come across. It just, I think the evolution has become that we really have started to understand the land where we're growing grapes.
Well, you naturally took me to my next question. You've obviously been instrumental, the power behind Petaluma AVA. Congratulations on getting that done. That was a labor of love and a lot of sweat. How many years did it take you?
Well, it's interesting. It took about, I would say that between the time that we started fantasizing or talking about trying to understand it and it happening, it was about 10 years, wow. 8 to 10 years. As you see it clearly, I'm always going forward. So I never know how long things took. I just know what we want to do next. But it was a part of that need to find and understand who we were. And I now see that, as you said, the aha moment. For me, understanding where we had bought our property, I didn't choose where we bought the property. I didn't even choose the first varietals that we planted. And so it's sort of, I had to understand who we were without having chosen who I was. So it was as a family and as an individual, that was what led me to really join the association and start tasting the wines and understanding what was going on. And from the first time I approached the Petaluma Gap organization, and then a few years later when I came back and was trying to understand it with a bit more maturity, and now I realize that a lot has happened in 30 years in the Petaluma Gap.
Join us next week for the conclusion of this interview. And thanks again for listening to the official podcast of Palate Exposure with Alona Thompson. See you next week.